She came from Providence, one in Rhode Island, where the old world shadows hang heavy in the air. She packed her hopes and dreams like a refugee, just as her father came.
Hi folks, Bob Main here with another episode of today's Survival Show, helping you harness the power of choice to live life the way you want to live it on your own terms and to strengthen your resolve. Our goal is to make survival simple, not extreme. And this is a practical show. If you're tuning in for the first time, welcome. I'm honored. You're not going to find a whole lot of conspiracy theories here. We're not into paranoia and stuff like that. This is just good common sense, how to live a more successful and secure life. And today is a little bit different than most of my shows. I have another guest podcaster who has volunteered his services on desert survival and surviving in the desert, preparedness and comfort. If you're passing through the desert, if you live in the desert, if you're going on some activity out in the desert, you are going to like this show. This is LV Mutineer. That's his username on our forum. If you haven't joined our forum, go to todayssurvival.com/forum or go to the main page, todayssurvival.com. LV Mutineer. You are going to love this, folks. Very, very informative. And, you know, I like to try to do this every Friday where we have a guest doing a podcast for this show. So even if you're not a member of our forum, if you have an area of expertise and you'd like to make a recording and you'd like me to put it on this show, I would be happy to do that. Let me go ahead and extend that invitation out to everybody once again. Just email me in advance, give me an idea of what you want to do, make a recording, and email it to me. It's pretty much as simple as that. So I'm going to turn him on here in just a minute. Really think you're going to like this. I just want to say one more thing real quick. Please don't forget to subscribe to this show if you haven't already. There's a subscribe button on the main page, or if you're listening on iTunes, you can go to iTunes and you can search Today's Survival Show. Without any further ado, let me go ahead and introduce to you LV for Las Vegas, LV Mutineer, talking about desert survival, preparedness, and comfort. Here you go.
Hello everyone, my name is Frank Simpson. If you're on the Today's Survival Show forum, you may recognize the name LV Mutineer. That's me, I'm on the forum. If you listen to Today's Survival Show and you're not on the forum, it really is a great exchange of ideas. I'd like to thank Bob Main for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today about desert preparedness, comfort, and survival. What is a desert? A desert is, the definition is a place that receives less than 10 inches of rainfall a year. The reason I bring that up is that it's not obvious. Most people think of a desert as a place that's very, very hot, and that's not the case. High desert, desert in wintertime, even at low elevations, temperatures at night can reach freezing. For sometimes we get temperatures in Las Vegas that are freezing or just below freezing for a week or more in the wintertime. That doesn't seem like a big deal to those of you who live in colder climates, but it's a big deal if you're not prepared for it. If you're expecting a hot desert environment and you're not prepared for a cold desert environment, obviously you could be quite uncomfortable. And my talk today will be targeted mostly towards my home in the Mojave Desert. There are four deserts in North America. I'll get to that in a minute. But much of it can be applied to arid environments, and some of it's just general survival principles. What qualifies me to speak on this subject is that I have spent an extensive amount of time in the desert, hiking, backpacking, four-wheeling. I've tried my hand at gold prospecting and some native crafts, and I've spent a lot of time reading and researching this topic. I'm not going to suggest anything that I haven't done or tried or wouldn't do, and my submitting this podcast comes from a sincere desire on my part for you to have a safer and more comfortable and enjoyable visit if you come to or are traveling through the desert. However, I want to make it clear that I'm not an expert. I have no degrees or certificates. And when you follow the suggestions that I make in this podcast, you do so at your own risk. Okay, down to brass tacks. Why should you care about desert survival if you don't live in the desert? Well, the answer is that one-third of the Earth's surface is arid or semi-arid. Arid or desert, as we just talked about, is less than 10 inches of rainfall a year. Semi-arid is less than 20 inches of rainfall a year. So that's a lot of ground to cover, literally. If a disaster or emergency strikes and you're flying over, traveling through, coming to visit, lots of scenarios. It's not a bad idea to have this general information in the back of your mind if you travel at all. The four deserts of North America from north to south are the Great Basin Desert, the Mojave Desert, which is where I am, the Sonoran Desert, and the Chihuahuan Desert. And that one is in, I believe, it's parts of Texas and New Mexico, and it extends quite a way into Mexico. Okay, I'm not going to get too much into situations why you might have an emergency in the desert. We'll kind of talk a little bit about vehicle versus being on foot and so on and so forth. But they could include a driving breakdown or if you're on a scenic tour or a bus or a helicopter scenic tour, which there are lots of, hiking injuries, stuff like that. To my way of thinking, the most important survival tools that you possess are your mind and your body. And the reason that I'm separating them is because everything needs to be thought of in terms of your mind being the driver and your body being the vehicle. And we'll get to sort of why I'm breaking it down that way in a little bit. The other thing that I want you to remember, especially in the desert, is that everything is water. Everything that you do costs you water. And there's so little of it. It is a precious resource. And we're going to talk about ways to conserve it in everything that you do when you're in a desert emergency situation. Another thing that's important is to look to the natives. What are the natives doing? A small example in Las Vegas, natives are few and far between. Most of us are from somewhere else. But if you were to drive by, let's say, a construction site in the summertime, you would not see the construction workers wearing short-sleeve shirts or shorts. Now, they wouldn't wear shorts, obviously, because of the dangers of the job, but they're going to wear long-sleeve, light-colored shirts. And that's because the sun here is so intense that it really can make your skin uncomfortable, never mind the sunburn or cancer risks, but the actual physical discomfort caused by direct contact with the sun for long periods of time. Also, light colors reflect the sun, as we know, and dark colors absorb it. So if you're wearing a black t-shirt and you're walking the strip, you are going to be very uncomfortable. I know, because I've had jobs where I had to go to work in black clothing, and just riding in the car and the sun coming through the window, I had to cover up with a t-shirt that I had sitting on the passenger seat. Okay, we'll talk about other ways to look at the natives a little bit later. So, urban comfort. The most likely situation that you're to encounter is that you've come for a visit or on vacation or whatever. We talked about light colors. Breathable fabrics are a must. I recommend cotton in the desert because cotton is going to absorb your sweat, and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to be sweaty and uncomfortable. But man, when you sweat and there's a little bit of a breeze and that cotton has held your sweat and that breeze comes along, and you might be physically cold for a second, even on a really hot day, and you get that, I know that in cold climates, cotton can be the kiss of death, right? If it's freezing outside and you're working and you're sweating and then you stop working and you cool off and that cotton just makes you cold and hypothermia can set in. But here, it's absolutely the opposite. Cotton is a great fabric to have. And that evaporation is really going to help cool your body. Carry water and drink often. Really, again, really obvious. But people come and they wear black clothes because they want to look cool, and they walk the strip and they're drinking alcohol all day and they're out in the sun, and the next thing you know, they are dehydrated or have heat exhaustion. And save your drinking for nighttime. In the daytime, drink water. Hydrate yourself. Okay. That's urban comfort. That's all the time I'm going to spend on that. We're going to talk now about survival emergency situations. I don't know how many of you have heard the rule of threes, but we're going to talk a little bit about that and how it relates to the desert and how it relates to water. The rule of threes states that you can last 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food, and 3 months without hope. Okay, those are maximum values as far as I'm concerned. If you're in perfect physical condition and everything after your emergency starts goes right for you, the rule of threes might apply. But those are maximum values, and I think in most cases, some of that is much less. For instance, 3 minutes without air, well, there are not too many people that I know that can hold their breath for 3 minutes. So that's 3 minutes if someone comes along, sees that you're unconscious, and administers rescue breathing. Okay, you get the idea. So how does this all relate to the desert and water? 3 minutes without air. The reason that I want to talk about air is that if you're exerting yourself, you're in an emergency situation in the desert and it's hot, you're wasting water. If there's a physical exertion that you can put off until dark, that you don't necessarily need to be doing. Picture your breath on a cold day, right? You can see the water vapor coming out. That's happening all the time. If you've ever slept in a tent and closed the vent to try and keep it warmer in there, you wake up in a puddle, and that's because the human body at rest, while you're sleeping, while your breathing is slow and even, an adult is going to lose about a pint of water just through respiration. So imagine how much water you're losing if you're exerting yourself and you're in the sun and you're sweating and it's hot. So any physical activity that can be put off until dawn or dusk, when you can still see but when the sun is not baking down on you, okay, that's air. 3 hours without shelter. Your first line of defense in terms of shelter is going to be a hat. And I didn't mention that in the urban comfort section, and I should have. A hat with a brim that goes all the way around your head. Not a baseball cap. Lots of outdoorsmen wear boonie caps or campaign hats. I don't like them for the desert because that heavy cotton fabric and those two little brass vents, it makes my head too hot. I like a straw hat of any kind. And if you feel like that's not fashionable enough for you, you know, a baseball cap's better than no cap, but a hat, and keeping your head cool and keeping your brain cool, that's your first line of defense. That's the first part of shelter. Light, loose clothing we've talked about. If you find a place to wait out the heat of the day, try not to sit directly on the ground. Chances are the sun has moved across the spot where you are, and the rocks and the dirt in the desert are going to absorb that sun's energy, and the ground is going to be hot. If you can, without expending too much energy, dig away a little loose dirt. You know, kick the rocks away, not just for comfort, but because they're hot. Find something to sit on. Grab something out of the car. You know, even a paper fast food bag can be better than sitting directly on any insulation that you can get between you and the ground. Don't stay in the car. A closed up car, and I know that no one would do this, although we get a couple of items on the news every year about people leaving children in their cars and the children die. The temperatures in a closed car in the Las Vegas area can go 140 degrees. I've heard the figure 160 degrees. I don't know if that's correct, but that's really hot. And even if you have all the windows rolled down, it's a big metal car, and it's going to absorb the sun's energy, and it's going to be hotter than the surrounding desert. I like to have a few just space blankets in the car. These aren't just for cold weather. You can close them in the car door and stretch them out and put a couple rocks on the ground, and you've got a little lean-to shade shelter. This particular area of the desert is loaded with creosote bush. You can either tie the blanket to it or poke a hole in the blanket and stick it over a branch and do a lean-to shelter. In that way, get yourself some shade and wait out the heat of the day. Water. 3 days without water, right? The next part of the rule of threes. And that's obviously a maximum. A person exerting themselves in the sun is going to use more than 1 gallon of water in a day. Try not to exert yourself, as we've said. Don't ration your water. They find people dead with water in their canteens because they're rationing water out. Also, the 3 days without water, when an emergency strikes, the clock doesn't start ticking when the emergency strikes. The clock starts ticking when you had your last drink of water. If you haven't had anything to drink since that, you know, fast food stop or that bottle of water that you had in the car a couple hours ago, your emergency started then. Okay. Don't ration your water. Drink often. Drink, they say to drink even when you're not thirsty. It's difficult for me to do, but keep your water accessible so that you see it, so that it's on your mind, and it encourages you to hydrate yourself. The rationing water thing, the analogy, we're going back to the your brain being the driver and your body being the car. If you're going on a trip and you had a car that was, you know, like 40 years old, and it used some oil, and it was a little low at the beginning of the trip, you wouldn't say, all right, well, I've got these 2 quarts of oil, and I'm going to stop every so often and pour a little oil in. Of course not. You would fill it up and make sure that it was full, and you would go on your trip, and you would add oil as necessary. Well, you need to think of water in those terms. Fill yourself up with water, and then use it as necessary. Another reason for that is because, and I'm not going to get into a lot of first aid, but one of the symptoms of dehydration is mental confusion. Now, I don't like my children to use the word stupid, but in this case, because I want to drive a point home, when we talk about when we go hiking, and I say if something happens to me while we're out hiking, I mean, my children know what to do, but they've been drilled on that not drinking can make you stupid. You're going to lose your mental acuity. You're going to make poor decisions. You're going to become confused. Maybe you end up making a wrong turn or deciding to hike out when you know that you should wait for the heat of the day to die down. That's a killer as far as I'm concerned. Okay. 3 weeks without food. You will survive until rescue without it, probably. Everyone's body is different. Everyone's metabolism is different. Some people have physical ailments where they need to eat, diabetes, for example, where they need to regulate their blood sugar. I know that I get extremely cranky when I don't eat. I might be, you know, a little hypoglycemic or something. But food costs water. Digestion costs water. From the moment you put it in your mouth and you wash it down with a little water, and then your stomach needs a little water to help create the juices that it needs to digest, and on down through the system, on through the excretion of wastes. All of that requires water. And so, hopefully, you've left word and someone knows when you're coming back, and when you don't, they're going to initiate a search, and you're in the area where you said you were going, and you're going to survive rescue without eating. I don't want people to go out there and, you know, have a medical emergency because I said that. Everyone is different, and every situation is different, but I want you to be very mindful before you are sitting beside your car with only a bottle of water and a bag of potato chips, right? That salt is a killer. Okay. The last rule of three, right? 3 months without hope. Hopefully, we're not talking about a, end of the world as we know it scenario or stink hits the fan scenario. In those situations, a desert is really not going to be a good location to try and ride out something like that. The natives, remember what I said, look to the natives? The natives that lived in this area before we came couldn't stay in one place. There weren't enough resources in one place to sustain them. A big part of their diet was pinyon nuts. Pinyon nuts, the pine trees don't form them every year. There's not enough water in the desert. Everything grows very slowly. The natives' emergency backup food was juniper berries. They would mold cakes and eat them, and I've tried them, and they're not very good. That's why it was an emergency food for them, a starvation food, they call it. Juniper berries don't ripen every year. It takes up to 3 years for the juniper berries to ripen. So these people had to move from location to location. There's obviously not enough water. There are springs, but water doesn't do you any good if you've thinned out the game to a point where it's no longer sustainable to stay, and you've thinned out the supply of plants that would sustain you. You've got to move on. Now, like in the Las Vegas area alone, there are over 2 million people that are going to be vying for whatever resources the government can provide, and there's going to be people that are going to try and go out into the wilderness and go it alone and live off the land, and they're going to be vying for those resources. And that's going to get ugly. And it's so, so dry, and people are going to be cooking, and there's going to be fires. The desert is not a place to ride out a long-term emergency situation. Okay. So, down to, like, real situations and practical suggestions. When you're in a desert emergency or survival situation, the first thing to do, obviously, remain calm. Use your mind. Stop. Find a shady place to have a drink of water and think about your situation. Assess your situation. Now, a lot of survival people, books, and so on suggest that you build a fire to give yourself something to do as a comfort measure, to, you know, brew some tea or whatever. I'm saying that the desert is, number one, it's so arid, and most of the fire dangers are extreme. I've seen signs that, you know, when you go into some of the recreation areas, you're going to see signs, no fires, no charcoal, no smoking outside of your vehicle, because one stray spark could make the whole thing go up. It is a tinderbox almost everywhere out here at certain times of the year. And the wind can kick up, and they can be very violent. The winds will change at dawn and dusk as the sun moves across the earth, and the temperatures change. Warm air rises, cool air descends. It creates winds, creates breezes. Often there's a breeze in the morning, and it's still during the day, and there's a breeze at night. If you start a fire in the evening time to cook your meal, and that breeze kicks up and a spark goes, now you're trying to outrun a brush fire. We talked about you're not needing food for the short time that you're going to be out there until rescue. Unless you're facing hypothermia, unless you're very confident of your location, the way that you're going to build the fire, the size that you're going to make the fire, I don't recommend you make a fire. Also, in most areas of the desert, there's not enough fuel. So you're going to burn a lot of water gathering little twigs, because that's all there are at the lower elevations. There are no trees down there to make a fire. And the fuel that's there is going to be extremely dry, and it's going to burn very, very quickly. Okay, two scenarios that we can talk about that we can look at. The first one is if you told someone, if someone knows where you are, or where you're going, and what time you're expected to check in. I always, I take my girls on outdoor excursions a lot, and I leave a note for my wife saying what general area we're going to be in, and what time we'll check in by. We might not be home by dark. We love it out there, so we might not leave where we are until dark. But as soon as I make it into cell phone range, you know, right after dark, I'll call in and say, we're all right, we're back in the city, we're headed home, or we're going out for ice cream, or whatever it is. But establish a check-in time, whether you're going to be there, whether you're going to call, whatever. So in that scenario where someone knows where you are, an emergency occurs, you can expect rescue. The person that you left that information with will contact the authorities, and a process will begin to come find you. In that situation, the same, stop, get in the shade, have a drink, assess the situation. Now, you're going to have to assess whether to stay where you are, which is what I generally recommend, or whether you need to go to a different location. No further information that I can give you right now is going to help you with that decision. It's going to be very situation specific. But one question you can ask yourself is, will I reach my destination alive before help would have come and rescued me anyway? One thing that a lot of people don't think of in these situations is, let's say that you encounter your emergency situation, whether it's an injury or something else, at noon. Your check-in isn't until dusk. Let's say it's in the fall, so it's like 6 p.m. You've got 6 hours before anyone even starts to look for you. But your cell phone is on, you're in a remote area, and it's looking for signal, and looking for signal, and looking for signal. If it's not, if you've got signal, obviously you're going to make the call and help's on the way. But that's really not what we're talking about. So in this situation, one of the first things you do while you're assessing your situation is turn off your cell phone. No one's going to be looking for you until your check-in time. It's not going to do you any good to have the battery all the way run out when you need it. Okay, it's hot. You're in the desert. It's noontime. What are the locals doing? Well, there's no people. What are the animals doing? There are no animals out in the middle of the day on a hot day. They've all gone to ground, and so should you. Wait out the heat of the day. Boring? Yes. Hopefully, you've got a little survival kit, maybe with some cards or something like that. If there's someone with you or kids, you can play I Spy there under your shade shelter. Most of the desert animals, the mammals, are diurnal. It means they come out at dawn and they come out at dusk. So as soon as the heat of the sun is off at dusk, you start moving. If you're going to move, lots of times higher ground is a good idea in terms of visibility for rescuers and in terms of line of sight to a cell phone tower, maybe. I've gotten cell service in some really bizarre remote locations because I was on a mountainside and I was in line of sight of some tower that I couldn't see from where I was, but their signal. Try a text. Bob, in one of his earlier shows, mentioned that it uses a different part of the phone, and you can make text messages even if you have a really weak signal. Let me backtrack. Try a text at your check-in time. Power up your phone if you've gone to a higher location, have a little bit of service. Try a text. You may want to power down for another hour and power back up. Remember, the search isn't starting until a little while after your check-in time. If I set my check-in time for 6, probably my wife's not going to really start getting worried for another hour or two. And she's going to go, he should have checked in by now. Another good use for a cell phone, I've spoken with SAR in my area, the search and rescue. They've said that they have found people by the people holding up the illuminated face of their cell phone, and they've zeroed in on that from a distance of 3 miles. I have that from an actual rescuer that I spoke to. Okay. Scenario number 2. No one knows where you are. You haven't set a check-in time, or you've deviated from where you expected to be, and no rescue is expected. Well, now you're in the soup. For sake of this scenario, let's assume that you're 24 hours from a road or some other sign of civilization. Maybe it's due to remoteness or rugged terrain or injury. Step 1 is the same as before, right? Stop, get in the shade, take a drink, assess your situation. Okay, where is help? This is tougher in the desert than other places because there aren't a lot of railroad tracks to follow. There aren't rivers that you can follow downstream. You have 2 hopes here. One is that you have a general idea which direction the road was in or the nearest town is. Another hope is to get to a higher elevation. And I keep talking about higher elevations. Most people think of the desert as this flat, flat place. In the Mojave Desert, in my area, the state of Nevada has 300 named mountain ranges. There's almost no place that you can be, at least in southern Nevada, that I've found where you can't see higher ground. The problem with that is, according to the Army Field Manual, and I believe this is true, most people underestimate their distance in the desert by a factor of 5. So when you're looking out at the mountains, and you think, okay, that's about 5 miles away, multiply it by 5. Okay, that's 25 miles away. I am not going to make it there today. Okay, so the higher ground thing, not only for cell phones and for signaling rescuers, but also because once you get up there at night, chances are you might see lights somewhere. It could be a a mine, a gypsum mine, or a power substation, or a railroad crossing on a dirt road that wasn't visible from down low where you were. So sleep away the darkest part of the night. As soon as it's light enough for you to move without hurting yourself, orient yourself, find a landmark that's in a direct line with the light. And, you know, as the day comes up, you won't see the light anymore, but you'll have a fix on that landmark and be able to head towards that location. Other civilization locators, obviously, lots of green vegetation. Chances are, if there's water in the desert, it's either part of a wildlife refuge or there's civilization there. Long, clear geography lines. Lots of times roads are laid in along long, clear geography lines, whether it's alongside of a cut or a wash or something like that, because people will lay in the roads, you know, along the easiest route. Okay. Out in the desert, because there's not a lot of rivers and so on, there are things that we call washes, which is places where water flows when it rains and only when it rains. They're not dried up creek beds or anything like that. There never was a source there. It's just either melting snowfall in the mountains or thunderstorms up at higher elevations. The desert soil forms a crust. It's a... I know I'm going to be wrong if I say that. I want to say that it's a bacteria, but it's alive. The soil is alive, and it forms this crust, and it knits it together. And that's why we don't get really bad dust storms, but it also means that when it rains here, the water doesn't soak in. It flows over top of this, and it carves channels out of the desert. And these are called washes. And walking in washes is fine. Sometimes it's the easiest way to go. It doesn't give you a lot of... sight, a lot of visual out into the desert around you, but it can be a lot easier if you're in a very brushy area. But I want you to keep an eye out for a lot of debris high up on trees or rocks. This is called bearding, and it gets there because when it rains far off, there's a flash flood, and the sticks and twigs and debris are carried in the flood, and they get pounded into these rocks and trees, and they just form, it almost looks like a beaver nest. And it's or a beard. That's why it's called bearding. And so when you see that, and hopefully maybe we'll try and post some pictures on the forum. When you see that, you know that you're in a flash flood zone. You want to be listening for a sound of wind, and you want to be listening for a sound like a train. Because what can happen is on a perfectly clear day, it could be raining. Up in the mountains where you can't see around the bend of the wash, there could be a small storm. And that water will come running down that wash, and you'll have no idea until you hear it. And then it's time to hurry up and get up and get out of the wash. So I want you to be aware if you choose to hike in a wash. And we hike in washes all the time, and you see the bearding all the time. But you just need to be mindful of that. Desert wildlife. Should you be afraid? You know, lots of people, when they think of the desert, they think of scorpions and rattlesnakes and Gila monsters, which are the only poisonous lizard that I'm aware of, and spiders and mountain lions and coyotes. Let's go through it quickly, one at a time. All of the animals out here, with the exception of coyotes around urban areas who are losing their fear of man and becoming a problem, all of the animals out in the desert are afraid of you. They don't want anything to do with you. You're not part of their normal food chain. And to most of them, you are a giant. If a giant came bounding into your backyard, you would be afraid of it unless you had really, really, really large weapons. Rattlesnakes. Unfortunately, the Mojave rattler that lives in this area is one of the most potent of that family. It's a really nasty customer. However, 40% of all venomous snake bites in America were caused by someone intentionally putting themselves in harm's way. Intentionally putting themselves in harm's way. That means they saw a rattlesnake and they decided to mess with it. They decided to play, you know, Steve Irwin or whatever and try to pick up the snake or hit it with a stick, and they were bitten. Most of the time, rattlesnakes are going to hear you're coming. They're very sensitive to vibrations. They're going to feel your footfalls and vibrations in the ground, and they're going to skedaddle. If you hear that telltale rattle, stop. back out of that area, and go around. It's as simple as that. In all of my excursions in the desert, I've never had a problem with the rattlesnake. Scorpions. Scorpions, they're out there. I've seen them. I've never been bitten. I've heard the bark scorpion, which is one that has migrated up from the Sonoran Desert, is a nasty customer. We almost sat on one fishing. Bark scorpions are so named because they like shadowy places under the bark of trees and whatnot, although I've found them on rocky lake shores. That was the one in question when we were fishing. The rule is, in the desert, never put your hands and feet in a place where you can't see them. Whether you're climbing a rock, whether you're not paying attention to what you're doing and are going to go to sit down or lean against something, always, before you put your hands or feet somewhere, look where you're putting them, and you're going to avoid any problems with scorpions. Gila monsters, there are extremely rare. I've never seen one, and they're not a real worry. Tarantulas, there are tarantulas out here. Tarantulas are very shy. They are very gentle, and again, unless you're messing with them, unless you're handling them, unless you are being foolish, they're not to be worried about unduly. Again, just watch where you're putting your hands and feet. The brown recluses and black widows are the colors that describe them. The black widow has a red hourglass on its back. The brown recluse has, I believe it's a black fiddle-shaped mark on its back. The same advice applies. Don't put your hands or feet where you can't see them. These are nocturnal creatures. It's not a huge worry. I'm fairly certain that all of the lizards that you're going to encounter, they're very fast, they're very skittish, they're going to leave you alone. Coyotes are not going to mess with you. Coyotes want game that's easy, or at least not as big or bigger than they are. Even though they're hunting in packs, and you may hear coyote song out in the desert, they're not a concern. Unless you're very close to an urban area where they've lost their fear of man, then they can become aggressive when they expect you to feed them. In the desert, I'm not aware of any coyote attacks outside of Southern California urban areas where coyotes have become a problem. There was one death in the Northeast, but they are fairly certain that coyote was a coyote and wolf half-breed. And the desert coyotes are much smaller than their eastern and northern counterparts. Mountain lions. If you're up high, there are mountain lions. They are few and far between. They do occasionally attack people, usually small children. And what I tell my children when we're out in the wilderness and we go hiking up there is don't run. Don't run ahead. Keep your children with you, you know, within, whatever you consider to be a safe distance, and make sure that they don't run. They don't run away. They don't run ahead. And what I tell my children is prey runs. Food runs. You are not food. You don't run. Not out here. There are wild Mustang out here. Nevada holds almost half of the nation's wild Mustang population. They are becoming a nuisance because people are feeding them, and they can be dangerous. You might mistake them for a domestic horse, but it's a wild animal. They can be unpredictable. However, if you don't mess with them, they're not going to mess with you. They are not out looking for trouble. Mustangs and horses in general seek calmness. They seek peace. One thing to remember when dealing with Mustang is if you're facing them, you're impeding their progress. So they might not go away. If you're in their front 180 degrees of the front of that animal, because they don't think in terms of backing up. So if you move off to the side, if you don't want an encounter and move off to the side, chances are the Mustang will lose interest in you and turn or continue on its way. Plants. Just give a wider berth from the cactuses than you think. Some of the spines, they don't jump, but they can fall off on the ground. I've sat on more cactus than I've been stuck by walking by because the spines fall on the ground they dry out and they blow away from the plant. Carry some tape. Carry some duct tape with you for removing the very, very fine ones and a small pair of tweezers. Okay, gear. Less is more. I'm not going to get into really specific gear stuff. You should bring something to make shade with. You should bring something to signal with during the day. I have a signal mirror that I've cut down to fit inside an electrical tape case, which is all my emergency kit. I have another electrical tape, you know, the little plastic case that it comes in, for my first aid kit. A fire starter of some kind. I like just a few matches because I'm not really going to do a lot of fire starting, as we've covered. First aid, knife, and string, and all the water you can carry. The specifics of your gear, everyone's got a gear list. I'll probably post something about my kit on the forum somewhere. Extended survival. We've already talked about the desert's not a good place to ride out a long-term emergency. There are some types of cactus leaf that you can eat. There are some types of cactus fruits that can be eaten. The prickly pear, for instance, and the leaves of that plant as well. But there's more than one species. They have spines that are so fine you can't see them until they're in your hand. And let's hope you realize that before they're in your mouth. I don't even want to think about that scenario. They're tiny, they're white, they're nearly invisible. You've got to do a lot of work to get rid of them. Singe them in a fire. There are other methods. There's a great website called desertusa.com, I believe, and hopefully I'll try to put a link to that on the forum as well, that has more information on all of these things. Pinion nuts, we talked about, was a staple for the Native Americans. Juniper berries, we talked about, as an emergency food. Juniper berries as an emergency food must be dried. They must be dried. Their juice is a diuretic. You will have a net water loss. Okay, like I said, there are other websites and resources if you want more detailed information on this. I really don't want to give out information on what desert foods to eat because people are different. People are allergic. Metabolisms are different. You just have to try a tiny little piece before you eat a whole lot of it because you could have an allergic reaction where someone else might not, or it could be a poisonous plant. There aren't a lot of poisonous plants in the desert. There are more poisonous flowers. I don't like to talk a lot about food procurement because my feeling is it's a waste of time that you could have been using to take steps to be rescued. Water procurement. My trying to teach you about water procurement in the desert is like teaching a class on winning the lottery. Yes, there's some water out there here and there. Your chances of being near it are slim. Your chances of finding it if you're near it are slimmer. Spend that time trying to get rescued. But, obviously, lush, green, low-lying vegetation is an indicator of water. Sometimes in the washes, if you're traveling in a wash and you find mud, hey, you know, you might be able to dig and find some water there. Also, the sandstone here can form potholes. It was formed over millions of years of water flowing over it from glaciers. And I guess one thing that most people don't know is that the western United States 300 million years ago was part of a shallow sea. And obviously a lot of seismic activity and geologic activity has happened in that time. But there's a lot of rock out here that was eroded by water. And so there are these potholes that form, particularly in the sandstone because it's so soft. And you can find water in there. When you find water in one of these potholes, chances are there's going to be animal droppings all around it, because the animals have found it also, and there's going to be green, slimy algae in it. And I wouldn't recommend drinking it unless you've got a surefire way to purify it extremely well or distill it. Okay, a couple of misconceptions about water in the desert. One thing that you hear people talk about, that you see on websites, that you see in survival books, is called a solar still. And we'll try to find pictures of that and post it. It's essentially if you dug a square hole, a foot or 18 inches, or, you know, they have all different sizes and configurations. So you dig that hole in moist soil or soil that has some moisture content. You put a container in the middle of that hole. You cover it with clear plastic, and you seal the edges with rocks and dirt. And then you put a rock in the center. So in the center of that piece of plastic, it bows down. The water, the moisture in the soil will condense on that plastic, run down to the center where you've set that rock, and drip into your container. And the problem with that in the desert is, number one, the soil's not moist here. It just isn't. There's a crust on top that keeps the water out. You can't get blood from a stone, and you can't get moisture from your average hunk of desert soil. If you manage to find a muddy patch, it's because it was in the shade, and there wasn't the sun beating directly down on it to send that moisture away. So building a solar still in the shade, you're not going to get a lot of moisture. You're not going to get a lot in your container. All of these scenarios involve a lot of digging, a lot of work, and they involve you having a big hunk of clear plastic with you. This is a net water loss. If you manage to get water from your solar still in the desert, which I doubt, you will have lost a huge amount of water digging the hole and setting the thing up. There are anecdotal stories about people surviving by drinking urine. The problem with this is, these people will say, well, urine is 95% sterile water. Right, in a healthy person. If you're to the point where you're considering this method, you're not healthy. You're extremely dehydrated. The amount of sterile water in your urine is going to be way lower. It is going to be way more full of toxins. It could make you vomit, which is a net water loss. And it's not healthy for you at all. Your body did a lot of work trying to get rid of the stuff. Now, one thing that I've thought of, and I want to try and experiment on this, is if you were to do a small solar still. I always have a couple sandwich bags because I always bring sandwiches with me when I'm out. And you might be able to build a miniature solar still based around a spot in the soil and distill urine in that way. You put one of the plastic bags in a deeper hole and so on and so forth. You could kind of get the idea. But I haven't tried that. It's something that I want to do an experiment on, and it's a possibility. And the last misconception is barrel cactus. There's a cactus out here that's shaped like a barrel, and you'll read lots of manuals or find it on websites that say this: you can get water from this and you can survive. Maybe. This cactus contains acids and alkali inside of it, and it can make you sick to your stomach. Some of the stuff that I've read suggests that you only consume its pulp or get the water from it if you have a full stomach to counteract those acids and alkali. Well, if you have a full stomach, you're going to be using all that water to digest the food that you ate to get the full stomach to get the water out of the cactus in the first place. So it's at best a draw, probably a net water loss because of the work that you have to do to cut the cactus open. Okay, so before I sign off, I did want to make one correction, and that was earlier when I was talking about coyotes, and I said I hadn't heard of any coyote attacks outside Southern California. What I meant was any serious coyote attacks or attacks that resulted in death besides the one that I mentioned in the East. There have been attacks. You have to wonder if the people were messing with the animals or enticing them in some way, as with the rattlesnake attack situation. In any case, don't be overly concerned. You'll see the coyotes. They may come check you out. Be wary, but don't be overly concerned. All right, that's all I have. Thanks for giving me some of your valuable time to listen to my talk about desert preparedness, comfort, and survival. Thanks a lot.
Nice job, Frank. Thank you very much. I learned a tremendous amount from that, and I hope that you did too. I just want to close the show by saying one quick thing. If you'll notice something about this blog, this podcast, the forum, and the chat room, is that I don't put hardly any advertisements on it. It's not peppered with a whole bunch of advertisements, and I like to keep it that way. I want you to learn from this, and I want this to be a content-based program. However, this show survives on the kind donations from listeners. That's it. I don't make a full-time living at this, and I don't intend to. But if you feel like you've benefited from this show or any of the other shows that I've recorded previous to this, or that our guests have recorded. I'd like to ask you to support the show if you can find it within your heart to do that. There's a donate button on the front page. No high pressure, though, folks. I don't believe in that. Whatever amount you can do, if anything. And if you can't, just keep living a more secure life by putting into practice what you learn on this show. And I'll leave it at that. So thanks again for tuning in. This is Bob Main, and that was LV Mutineer from our forum. I'm signing off. I just want to say we make survival simple, not extreme. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.
She begged her hopes and dreams like a refugee, just as her father came across the sea.